Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 33 of Nerd Pride Radio. 33, the number of vertebrae in the human spine. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's probably seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place where I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. Oh, and my co-host today, my favorite Sith Lord, Darth Jurius, or as his frat brothers call him, Spike. Welcome, Spike. Right into the show. Updates! Guess what? Last week I talked about the James Webb Space Telescope, the coolest telescope ever conceived of by mankind. The thing is going to be 21 feet across. It's massive. It's going to outdo Hubble in every way. We're going to look at planets around other stars. One scientist bragged that we would be able to see the beginning of time with this thing. He might be right. Okay, I raved last week about how awesome I think the James Webb Space Telescope is, and yet I had it in my notes, and somehow I missed it. Do you know what the best part about the James Webb Space Telescope is? My favorite part about this thing is where they're going to put it. Right. None of this Earth-bound garbage, obviously. We're not even putting it in orbit around Earth. No. We're going to do Hubble 1 better, and this sucker is going to orbit the second Lagrange point of the Earth-Sun system, all right? We're going to put it in orbit around L2. It's going to wobble there at L2. Now, do you not know what a Lagrange point is? Because if you don't, I'm happy to explain. This is what's so cool about it. In any two-body system, in this case the Earth and the Sun, there are Lagrange points. These are balance points where a much smaller object could just stay there and everything's in balance around it. So, for example, Lagrange 1, L1, is the point where it's directly between the Earth and the Sun, and is the point where the gravity of Earth and the gravity of Sun balance out exactly. So that if you put something there, the sucker can hang there forever, all right? And it winds up orbiting along with the Earth and just staying right in that little balance point. Perfect, all right? And we've put stuff there before. We've put stuff there to observe the Sun and Mercury and Venus. L1 is very useful. All right, L2, this one's cool. L2 is actually just past the Earth, all right? So this is the point where the gravity of the Earth and Sun combined are just enough to balance out the centrifugal force of its orbit that wants to fling it out into space. So if we put the James Webb Space Telescope at L2, which is what we're going to do, it just hangs there, orbiting the Sun. In 1 year equals 1 year for this telescope, and it means it is perpetually in Earth's shadow. It always has the Earth directly between it and the Sun, which means no glare. Look at this. Perfect viewing conditions, or at least perfect viewing conditions, you know, this close into the solar system, right? Oh, this thing is so cool. How awesome that we're going to hang something at L2. I love that. But enough about James Webb. We're going to have to wait 6 years to see that sucker go up. But trust me, I'm going to be reading everything I can get my hands on about this thing between now and then. So that leads us directly to the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If anything strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list. And then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record, you lucky dogs. And what is on my master list this week? Well, first off, we're going to head over to my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, then I'm going to bring it here and share it with you. I'm sorry, I just realized I am talking really fast. I am super excited today. I don't know why I'm so hyped up to be recording, but I am. So, forgive me, I'm going to try and pace myself. We'll see if we can't bring this to a little lower level. Not quite so much tension for you. All right. On my gaming table this week, I have been playing Goblins with an exclamation point. I talked about Goblins a while back. It's a homebrew system. Essentially, the characters are all tiny people, anyone under 2 foot tall in a medieval fantasy setting. So they can play, you know, fairies, plant people, goblins, anything that's small. All right. And I'm pitting them up against humans, ultimately, who appear to be massive giants in this world. And it's worked out really well so far. But here's the twist for what we've been playing lately. The original game is, my three younger sons, who are playing a bird man, a plant man, and a small dragon, respectively. However, my nine-year-old, who's playing the bird man, has decided that he really, really, really wants to play out his backstory. He has a backstory that he comes from the mountains far away. His bird man guy is an expert with a spear, and glaive is actually his favorite weapon. And he has been a mercenary and weapons expert, and now he has found himself in this fairy forest where he is helping the people that live down here. And apparently, he's obsessing over this. He cannot stop thinking about, how did his character get here? Why is his character doing what he's doing, and what brought him from his mountains? Because he knows he had a family. He even has worked out that, you know, as we talked out who his character was, he worked out that he had a family, like a wife and children, and now they're all gone. He has left them, and he's gone somewhere else, and this bothers him really badly. Not that he wants a different character. He likes this about his character, but it bothers him that he doesn't have all the details yet. He wants to have a full story written out for this character. This is just part of his nature. And so he's been bringing things to me and saying, okay, is it possible that my character did this? I'm like, well, sure, if that's what you want. All right. And then we got to the idea of, as a reward for him, for some of his school stuff and homework stuff, as a reward, if he gets everything done, I'm like, you know what, we'll play like 20 minutes of a game at night. You know, we can't do long because it's a school night, we've got other things going on, but we'll give you 20, 30 minutes of Goblins. And he said what he really wanted was he wanted to play out a game, because it was just going to be me and him. He wanted to play out his backstory as an actual game. So now we're moving the whole game, you know, 10, 15 years into the past and playing this out for him. And he's having a good time. His only problem is he sees now, you know, he's back in the past, and we've seen the moment when his village is first overrun by goblins. All right. He's been driven out along with him and his best friend. And they've been driven out, and now they've got some people that they need to rescue and some things that they need to do. And it still constantly nags at him that, okay, here I am at this point, and I know I have my best friend Newt. And yet, when I'm playing in the later game, 10, 15 years later, I don't have Newt anymore. And so he wants to write out a whole story of what happened to Newt. And I'm torn because, I mean, I want him to have control here. I want him to feel like this is his story and he's making it happen. And yet, at the same time, it's still a role-playing game. And it's like, yeah, but okay, dude, here's the thing. You've got the foreshadowing. You know the end. You know how it's going to turn out ultimately. And you know how it started. You know where this earlier history sits right at the moment. But the mystery is that whole in-between. All right, how did you get from here to there? You don't have to write a whole story. Dude, let's play it out. I know the end game, all right? I know the end game, but I don't know the middle. As Game Master, I don't know it any better than he does. And so we're playing out these middle years, and he's finally getting a grasp on that. And it's just really cool. We're having a good time playing it out. But man, it's gonna take a little bit for him to fully let go and just enjoy the moment of it. The other problem I have, and this is with both of my Goblins games, is I feel stuck for ideas. I've just got Game Master block here, and I feel like, you know, first off, I have the ego part of me that says, dude, I'm good enough. I could just wing this, right? I mean, I'm playing for a 9-year-old here. How tough can that be? And so there are times that I sit down not fully prepared or not as prepared as I want to be, and the stuff that I'm spitting out, while I can make it exciting, still feels, in my mind, still feels a little rehashed. I feel like I'm not giving him the best game possible. Or when we play with all three of them, I'm not giving them the best game possible. It just feels... it feels a little rehashed, a little redone. And I just had an epiphany. I'm driving the other day. I'm listening to a podcast. Somebody else talking about it was a movie. And something about the movie they were talking about struck me that that's what's missing. You know what's missing? The magic, the power, the growth. Because I'm playing, you know, again, a 9-year-old, a 6-year-old. The older kid will do whatever. You know, he's, again, flexible. But I'm playing for little kids. And while they are very sophisticated kids in some ways, I'm playing a gritty sort of story. I'm playing the kind of game that I would play with an older group where it is more realistic. As realistic as you can get with fairies and goblins and this sort of thing. But I'm playing out a more a grittier feel, I guess. A low-power, low-magic campaign. And I realize that what's missing is the magic of it. The every kid show, everything that they watch, everything that they're excited about, all this stuff, you have these main characters who have fantastical powers. They come into fantastical powers. The discovery and the advancement, the stuff that when I was first playing, when I was a young kid playing role-playing games, you know, we saw that by, you know, we were constantly handing out magic items and constantly handing out all these treasures and rewards. And it was the gaining of power. It was a Monty Hall sort of thing that, yes, we were excited about the adventures and the battles and the stories, but also we really liked the advancement. And I realize I'm not giving my kids that because I don't use a whole lot of advancement. I use character development. And I don't think that's sufficient for these guys. And so my next trick is to try and figure out, okay, what sort of advancement can I grant them? And in the big campaign, well, that's easy. They can have whatever they want because, you know, as this story moves forward, you know, they're starting off very low power, low level. Let me introduce some magic, some cool stuff, some things that can advance them, and they can feel awesome, feel badass, finding out new powers, learning new things, having new places to go. That's all well and good, but what do I do for the 9-year-old in his backstory campaign? Because I want to give him stuff to keep him motivated, and I want him to feel that badassery, you know what I mean? And yet, we know where the end game is. We know where his character ends up 15 years from now. So, I don't know as a 9-year-old if he's ready for me to tell a story where I build him up to be this big hero with all these abilities and all this stuff going on. And then, it has to end in tragedy. The more I build him up in this game, the further he has to fall to reach the point where he starts the next one. And he wants this to be a consistent character. This is really important to him. So, I don't know. I'm gonna kind of feel him out on this as we play, and see how he's gonna react to some of this. Because again, I want it to be fun for him. I want this to be something that he will talk about for years to come. Going, God, remember that? And it was just me and you. And it was. I want him to love it. But I don't know. I don't know if he's. I think he can handle that kind of arc. I know I can. I'm thrilled to death. I'm excited by the challenge of creating an arc that builds him up in power, ability, wealth, whatever it is, whatever the reward is, but it builds him up, and then at some point, he's going to have that ultimate tragedy, that ultimate fall that marks the end game for this particular storyline, and then allows him to have his seamless story of where he came from, so that he can play in the new game, the next game, original game, he can play in that with all this rich backstory to go with him. I'm thinking we can make that work. And it might even, you know what? And now that I think about it, it might even add the motivation that we need to the next game where his goal then is to recover something that he's lost or to avenge something that happened to him or to, you know what? I think this will work out. All I need to do is talk to you guys. God, I feel so much better now. Thank you. And if James Webb wasn't enough for you, I've got a little more stuff over the science corner.
Ooh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
That's right. Mr. Shatner's dulcet tones means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. Okay, this is just a fascinating bit of technology news for me. Just a week ago, not even a week ago, September 2nd, they held the 70th annual Hugo Awards. You're all familiar with the Hugo Awards. The awards for the best and newest in science fiction and fantasy. These are the Hugo Awards. It's very prestigious. It's very cool. I love the Hugo Awards. And they ran them this year. If you wanted to catch the Hugo Awards, you had to watch them on Ustream. All right? They weren't being broadcast anywhere because, for God's sake, it's the Hugo Awards. Apparently, even Sci-Fi Channel wasn't handling that. So, you had to watch it on the internet on Ustream. And that's how you would see the Hugo Awards live. And what happened during the Hugo Awards? Did you hear this? Okay. Right in the middle of the Hugo Awards, they're just about to hand out an award to someone from Doctor Who for something amazing with Doctor Who that was clearly well-deserved, I'm sure, and suddenly the broadcast cuts out. Because Ustream's copyright protection robots identified the clips that were being shown in the Hugo Awards stream. They identified that there were copyrighted clips from Doctor Who, as well as other stuff, but they recognized that there were copyrighted clips being shown on this stream, and so they cut it. The robots just killed the stream. It's all automated processes. Ustream apparently has robots that do just this to protect them from copyright infringement, to protect them from lawsuit. They keep copyrighted material out of Ustream's bandwidth, and those robots went ahead and caught the Hugo Awards and said, yeah, no, we're not having any of that, and they cut it off. Okay, I see how that could happen. All right, but the problem with that is that the Hugo Awards were completely legal and sanctioned. First off, even if they hadn't had permission to use the clips they were using, the clips were still legal through fair use. It's an award show, and showing clips of award winners is perfectly legal fair use no matter where you are. But secondly, they had explicit permission from the people who created the clips, because they provided them with the clips. Those people gave them the clips to show at the Hugo Awards. All right, so there's no illegality going on here, nothing. It's all perfectly above board, perfectly legitimate stuff, and the robots killed it. So, the response from Ustream was nothing. Sorry, there's nothing we can do about this. Sorry, there's no way to take care of it. Sorry. The stream is just dead, and no one will see the Hugo Awards now. If you weren't there in person, you didn't see them. And that's just the way it goes. All right. Now, having done all this, this is a horrible tragedy and a horrible misuse of technology in that it killed something good and legal and legitimate, and now we'll never have another chance to catch that. And the internet furor over this is huge. This is the evils of copyright enforcement, the evils of intellectual property laws and whatever, and that, you know, we need to adapt to the internet age, and we need to adapt to the, okay, great. Have all of your outrage, and I get that, but you know what? This was a single mistake that is a learning experience, and I will guarantee you it won't happen again. The Hugo Awards or any other similar awards show, any big-time production like this, will never have any problem again because, okay, look, it happened. God, I can't believe we didn't see that coming. We should have known that. We should have anticipated it. We should have fixed it. And for any later broadcasts, nah, they'll fix it. You know what? It'll be just fine, and they will mark out exceptions, and the robots will know better, and nothing will happen. But here's where I'm annoyed with it, is, yeah, for big productions, all right, for huge money productions, sure, they're never going to have any problem again because now they've seen the problem, they know how to handle it and anticipate it. But what's a guy like me going to do? Not that I'm using Ustream, not that I care, but what about someone like me? What about the little guys who have complete legitimate uses for some copyrighted material that they can legally use through fair use, all right? They're never going to get through. They're never going to get the permissions. They don't have the money. They don't have the time. They don't have the legal know-how to make sure that they get all this cleared ahead of time and that they're it's, I just don't see it happening. All right. And so what it means is great. If you're a big production company, you know, if you're a big event, if you're something huge, Ustream, no problem. If you're a little guy, guess what? Fair use doesn't mean crap on Ustream. All right. Or on any similar service, ultimately. That's where I think this whole copyright enforcement crap is going to come down on all of us, is that the people who already have the resources will be able to continue to have those resources. And people who don't, guess what? You don't get access to the same things. It doesn't matter if it's a perfectly legal and legitimate fair use of that material. You just can't do it. Sorry. You'll get cut out immediately. And that's just the way it's going to go. I wish I knew a good way to fix that, but I don't. Okay, but that's depressed me now. I need some music. Let's go. Science fiction, double feature. Oh, so much better. That's right. It's the science fiction double feature here at Nerd Pride Radio. You get not one, but two movie reviews for the same low, low price. And guess what? Actually, today, you get way more than that. All right? Because today, I am talking about the movies of 1999. All right? The other day, we had a day at home, and we were kind of cleaning up, doing some housework, doing some fix-it stuff. And with my older boys there, I said, hey, you know what I always do when I'm home alone and I've got housework and other stuff to do? I put on some of my favorite old movies in the background, and I just let them play. And it makes good background noise because I've already seen them, right? No big deal. And so I put in, as I usually do, Galaxy Quest. And I didn't realize that Galaxy Quest was from 1999, all right, which, now, you guys don't know this, but 1999 as a year for movies always stands out for me because my two favorite movies of all time are The Matrix and Fight Club, both of which came out in 1999. And I'm like, oh, hey, Galaxy Quest, also one of my favorite movies ever. Yeah, I know, it's corny, cheesy, hokey, stupid, whatever. Galaxy Quest is a genius piece of film. I've talked about it on the podcast before. Is incredibly well done. It's a beautiful Star Trek parody that is it mocks the tropes of Star Trek and other space opera stuff, but does it with so much love and attention to detail that I cannot help but love this movie. And I've watched it umpteen times and love it every single time I watch it. Well, Galaxy Quest also, 1999. I thought, wow, how cool is that? All right, then. The next movie they wanted to watch American Pie, which I've seen, but they haven't. And I thought, all right, cool, you guys can watch American Pie. This, you know, they're high school kids. This is a great movie for, you know, gross-out teen comedy. And we watched American Pie, and I'm like, wait a minute, American Pie, also 1999. I did not know that. And so I started looking, and this is just my movie collection, all right? And I don't have a ton of movies. But I have a lot of them from 1999. 1999 brought us Fight Club, Matrix, Galaxy Quest, American Pie. I've already mentioned those. But also Dogma? Kevin Smith's Dogma was 1999? I didn't know that. I own that one. I own all of these. American Beauty? Oh, American Beauty. That thing is so awesome. I Rule! All right? 13th Warrior. Kyle, did you know that? 13th Warrior, also 1999? I love 13th Warrior. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. Antonio Banderas, great. Dungeons and Dragons style movie. It was so Dungeons and Dragons that we did a whole podcast episode featuring that on the Animal Cast, on how cool a D&D movie that thing was. Being John Malkovich is on there. Mystery Men. All right, now, Mystery Men is a terrible movie. I get that, but I do own it and I do really, really love it. The Mummy, my favorite pulp action popcorn Saturday afternoon movie. I love The Mummy. All right, my wife and I love The Mummy. We watch it together. The later Mummy movies suck. Okay, great. But the original, great film. Love that one. Office Space, which I actually own two copies of, believe it or not. Office Space was 1999. Three Kings. Do you remember Three Kings? Oh, that thing is brilliant. All right, so all of these, 1999. Holy cow. And then I went and, so I look up, I'm looking up movies of 1999, and I don't own these two, but I want to say favorite, but maybe it's almost favorite. They're in the top five, top ten of my guilty pleasure movies, all right? Chick flick style movies that, yeah, I'm a little embarrassed that I really like them, but I do. Runaway Bride, which I've seen like 5 or 6 times, and I love Runaway Bride. And 10 Things I Hate About You. 10 Things I Hate About You is awesome. Every time, it's one of those movies, and there's about a half dozen or so of these. It's one of those movies that when it comes on late at night, it doesn't matter what point in the movie it's at, I'm flipping through channels. Ooh, it's 10 Things I Hate About You. Cool. And I'll stop there, and then I watch it until it's over. Every single time. I don't know what it is about that. All right. Those are all movies that I love from 1999. And I went out and I did some more looking now. I'm like, okay, maybe, you know what? Maybe all the years around then have really, really great movies. All right. And so, because this is, I have to count them up on the page here. But that is, okay, 14 movies that I really enjoy. 14 movies that I've seen repeatedly, all from that same year. And I thought to myself, all right, maybe every year has that many movies, and this one just happens to stand out because I happen to notice it. But no, I start flipping through. I looked at 1998, 1996, 2003, grabbed random years, and I just flipped through the whole list of movies. And one, I don't own more than one or two movies from any other year, really. And two, as I went through, and I'm like, okay, so for 1998 or 2003, I'm going through the list going, okay, how many of these movies do I love? How many would I put in the same category as this dozen or so that I have from 1999? And from each of those years, it was, you know, like 5, 8, 6. You know, it was never, 1999 just stands out, all right? And now, just to round it all out, also from that year, two movies that I greatly enjoyed, but I wouldn't necessarily put them in the same high tier as some of these others, but South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut was that year. Toy Story 2 was that year, which a lot of people have said was better than the original. I don't think so, but that's all right. I mean, I like Toy Story. I like Toy Story 2. Love Toy Story 3. These are all good movies. But Toy Story 2 was 1999. The Blair Witch Project and The Sixth Sense were both that year, and I, by the way, didn't like either one of those movies, but they're critically acclaimed, and lots of people did love them. All right, called them groundbreaking. Rushmore was that year. Rushmore, my least favorite movie of all time. I hate Rushmore. I mean, I hate it with a burning passion like you wouldn't believe because it's so mean. I don't find it funny. I just find it mean and painful. And yet, Rushmore is touted as a brilliant, brilliant piece of work, a masterpiece that Bill Murray's performances in that is stellar. I don't get it. Like I say, I have a tough time enjoying movies where there is no one to root for. Not, in fact, there's not even no one to root for. There's no one that I can even vaguely like. There was no likable character anywhere in there. It was tough, very tough. But anyway, Rushmore was that year. And last of all, since we are nerds, Star Wars Episode I, Phantom Menace came out in 1999. Again, not a great movie, but certainly a landmark. And it was all 1999. So, I am now officially proclaiming 1999 as the single greatest year in film during my lifetime. And you know what? You guys can argue with me. You guys can come up with your own years. You can say it's all coincidence. I don't care. There was something magic. Something magic in the Hollywood waters that year, and I'm thrilled for it. So, that is my, I guess it's more than a double feature, but that is my science fiction double feature. So, what's up next?
And now for something completely different.
Yeah, this is just stuff I don't have an official category for yet. This is, and I should have a category for this because this is superheroes. I should have a superhero category. I should have some cool bumper music for superhero stuff. They're not, you know, there's plenty of good Superman songs out there. Maybe Pocket Full of Kryptonite would be my great superhero theme. I just need a catchy name for the segment. Anyway, I'll work on that. It came up at work this week, as these topics often do. Why do so many superheroes wear capes? Seriously, what is it about capes? I mean, we've all seen The Incredibles. We've all read The Watchmen. We've seen The Watchmen movie, but we've read The Watchmen. We all know that capes are horribly, horribly impractical. For most of the things that you want to do as a superhero, you know, run, fight, do action-y things, having a cape is really, really inconvenient. I mean, especially these really cool super awesome looking floor length capes like Batman wears. Just not conducive to launching that good roundhouse kick to the face. You know what I mean? All right. In The Watchmen, it was, you know, got caught in a revolving door and pinned him there until the bad guys shot him. Capes are awkward, and yet they're so iconic. Everyone has a cape, and it's gotten to the point where in some comics, cape is a shorthand term. It's slang for superhero. It is so ingrained, it is so connected to the idea of superheroes that the word cape itself has come to mean superhero in some contexts. All right? So seeing as how they are so horribly, horribly impractical, why do so many of them wear them? All right. And here's the explanation I came up with, which I now think is completely wrong, but here's what I came up with. My first thought is Batman, one of the first great cape-wearing superheroes, but Superman as well, but Batman comes from Zorro, all right? And every depiction of Zorro that I've seen, Zorro comes with a cape, okay? Zorro comes from the Scarlet Pimpernel, all right? Which, despite the horrible, horrible name of it, Scarlet Pimpernel is probably the original proto-superhero. Right? This is a wealthy man who takes on a disguise to go out and fight injustice. He's the original Batman. All right? Pimpernel is cool. All right? And Pimpernel, cape. All right? But that's the problem then. With Zorro and Pimpernel, I don't know that I've read the original sources. I know a lot about both of them, but did they have capes in the original sources? I mean, a cape or a cloak? It would be a good accessory in whatever Victorian Renaissance era that the Pimpernel was running around. I think Pimpernel is Renaissance. Anyway, all right. Zorro, a cloak or cape is a good fashion accessory for a genteel Spaniard in Mexico at that time, I suppose. All right, but were they there in the original source material? I don't know. But that was my first thought, is that okay, so the early ones, it was, you could use a cape or a cloak to help with a disguise. If you're moving about in the shadows of the night before the turn of the 20th century, then wearing a cape or a cloak is a great way to hide yourself in the shadows, to blend in, to be unobtrusive. And then that cape from Pimpernel and Zorro kind of evolves into the Batman costume, the same sort of thing, especially with Batman being all shrouded in mystery as he is. The cape gives him the whole bat-like appearance. There's lots of good reasons for it, all right? And so that to me, seemed a logical origin for this. The better explanation I got, because I started looking it up online and I got other people's explanations, my favorite explanation is, why do so many superheroes wear capes? The answer is, well, to fly, of course. You can't fly without a cape, dummy. I like that one. Although someone asked, and I'm hoping this was tongue-in-cheek, but you can never tell with the internet. Someone said, yeah, why do superheroes wear capes? I mean, I always thought it was so that they could fly, because Superman flies and he has a cape, but, you know, Batman's got a cape and he doesn't fly. And then Green Lantern, he has no cape at all, but he can still fly. So if it doesn't have anything to do with flying, then what's the whole point of a cape? All right, I thought that was a great question. And no, the really great answer I got was, in early comic books, as long as you're making up a fantastical costume that doesn't have to have anything to do with modern fashion or realistic clothing, a cape is an awesome way in a comic to display action and motion. Oh, see, that's cool. That is something I can buy into. Because if you're Superman, and he does flying, he does a lot of landing. And then I thought about, yeah, when he's doing the landing, and he comes down and it's that iconic Superman landing pose where he's got the one foot up in the air, he's landing on the other foot, and the cape is kind of billowing a little bit behind him to give the indication of the airflow as he's coming down. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I can see that, all right? Or when you're doing a lot of whirling and twisting and jumping, yeah, cape would be great for that. It's just an indicator of action, a nice comic book artist shorthand for movement. So you didn't have to do movement lines as they often did in other comics. The Sunday comic strips, comic books, cartoons on TV, although this was before TV cartoons. But a lot of times you saw the motion lines being used. Well, but motion lines are a little unrealistic. And not that superhero comics didn't also use motion lines at times, but with the cape, you didn't have to. You can make it, you know, make it slightly more realistic by having the cape indicate your motion for you and save you the trouble of putting in extra lines or extra motion things to... Anyway, I just thought that was an awesome explanation. And of course, no matter what your explanation is for how capes got started, once they're there, once you have Superman wearing a cape and you have Batman wearing a cape, okay, that's it. That's the end of it, because those two defined superheroes for most people. And therefore, if Superman's got a cape and Batman's got a cape, everyone's got a cape. That's what being a superhero is. That's part of the costume. It's part of the required uniform. That makes sense to me. So anyway, I don't know the real answer to the question, but I like that one. That one makes a lot of sense. And that brings me to my badass movie quote of the week. Quote, think someone could spend half their life in the slam with a horse bit in their mouth and not believe? Think he could start out in some liquor store trash bin with an umbilical cord wrapped around his neck and not believe? Got it all wrong, holy man. I absolutely believe in God. And I absolutely hate the f***. End quote. And that, of course, was Vin Diesel as Riddick in the movie Pitch Black. And I have wanted to use that quote since the beginning of this show. I see it every week as I go through my list. And every time I skip it, because I know that if I do it, I'm going to have to go back and I'm going to have to bleep out the word. And I always forget to do stuff like that. And I'm always afraid I'm going to let that through. But this time, I'm going to take that chance because I love the quote. And I especially love the movie Pitch Black. All right? If you haven't seen Pitch Black, go watch it. All right? Because Pitch Black was a great small horror movie. A horror sci-fi. It wasn't horribly original. All right? And it certainly wasn't a big production job. It wasn't as big as some movies, but it was really effective. It was really creepy, and it was genuinely scary, and introduced Vin Diesel's Riddick character as this surprise anti-hero badass who just dominates this film, all right? And does it with a lot of mystery. He leaves a lot there because you don't need to know everything. You don't need... All you need to know is that this dude, for whatever reason, has wound up in this situation. And by the way, this is how you handle it. All right? And it all works out really, really well. All right, I love Pitch Black. I think it's a great film. Totally worth my time. And sadly, they then had to go and ruin it by making The Chronicles of Riddick. Because that was terrible. Terrible. You know what? That's part of what I loved about Pitch Black is he was just a... It felt like, even though he was ultimately the star behind the whole thing, he still felt like a minor character. He felt like just this background character who suddenly rises up and dominates everything and makes it cool, all right? But he was still shrouded in mystery, and that was all good. But then you go and make Chronicles, and you turn him into this huge thing, and it was, I felt like they really... really made a wrong move there. Although I'm sure they made a ton of money off of it, and it was so worth their time. But Pitch Black by itself, great film, never needed to go beyond that. Really didn't. And with all that out of the way, you know there's nothing left but the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog, this is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then send your question or your topic to me by email or, screw email. Better yet, send it to me in a private message on our Nerd Pride Radio forums, and I will add it to our Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And our first number, R2, is 64. This one comes from Jeff Hawes. Hi, Jeff. Love you. Jeff says, pick a famous family to become a member of for a year. Fictional or real world. Ooh. I hate these where I have to be creative on the spur of the moment. I am no good at this. All right, because my first instinct, gut instinct, is I want to be part of the Weasley family from Harry Potter. Because, you know, magic, right? How cool is that? Sure. Okay. But then I realized that, no, I have some real problems with Harry Potter, and I don't want to... It's not quite right. It just feels a little too... All right. So then I think, okay, well, wait. I'm reading Song of Ice and Fire right now. No, there is no family there I want to be a part of. Oh, God. I mean, as much as I would love to be a Stark of Winterfell, dude, people die. People die all over this. People are horribly tortured. People are, nobody wants to be a Stark of Winterfell. I mean, as awesome as they are, hey, winter is coming. Seriously. So I don't know. Maybe I go real world. Maybe I become one of Will Smith's kids for a year. That'd be kind of cool. I mean, seriously, because Will Smith is a pretty cool dude, and fantastically wealthy, and he'll make a career for me while I'm there, right? I mean, because that's what Will Smith does for his kids. He's cool that way. I could do that. But again, that's a little safe. Maybe I could become a member of the Firefly crew. I mean, they're looking for a new pilot, right? I could do that. Yeah, see? Because Firefly, I know what you're thinking, but they are a family, aren't they? Right? Okay, so there you go. I joined the crew of Serenity, and I have a great, wonderful new family around me, adventure all the time, and yet, even though they're family, I'm still allowed to hit on Kaylee. So, everything works out for the best. R2 gives us number 15. This one is from Mr. Ravemaster. Hello, Ravemaster. Ravemaster says, 2. Because I'm guessing this was number 2 in a long list of questions he sent me, and I separated them out. 2. If you could choose between heat vision and x-ray vision, which would you choose and why? Well, the x-ray vision? Duh, because then you can see through things. Then you can see secret things. You can see women naked. There you go. Assuming that you have the kind of cool x-ray vision that Superman has. Since we're giving heat vision versus x-ray vision, I'm assuming this is equivalent to whatever Superman can do. And while heat vision would be awesome to have a weapon, everyone knows that for men, the first consideration in getting a new superpower is, will this allow me to see women naked? And x-ray vision, by its very definition, is designed explicitly for that. So it's the only choice available to me. 29, Brasky. Brasky says, Transformers are overrated and were overrated even in the 80s. Stake out your position on this hot-button issue and defend it. Well, duh, of course they're overrated. All right, and first, I don't even know what's first because there's so much to say about it. But the truth is, Transformers are way overrated and not nearly as cool as everyone seems to think they are. All right, I get it. If you were that age and you played with the toys when you were a kid and you watched the cartoon, I can see the nostalgia factor. I understand that there's nostalgia for a lot of stuff that actually was always crap. And Transformers is one of those things. The first Transformers movie, the cartoon one that I went and saw in the theaters, was garbage. All right, and we knew it was garbage at the time we saw it. I was a little too old to play with the toys, so I wasn't in on that factor of it. But the later ones with their shaky cam and all this, I hate the new Transformers films. Hate them, and I hate that they make as much money as they do, and I hate that they have Shia LaDouche in them. There's just so much to not like about Transformers in general. And here's my one bit of tangible evidence to all of this. You know when I figured out that Transformers were overrated garbage? All right, because I did read the comic book when I was a kid. I did watch that first movie. I saw all that. When they introduced the construction robots, that they transform from construction equipment to robots and combine to make, I can't even remember, did they make a giant dinosaur or was it a huge Mixmaster? I can't remember. Some piece of kitchen equipment. I have no idea. But honestly, the construction equipment was when I finally realized the entire premise was so idiotic that I had no way to even absorb it anymore. I couldn't take it seriously. It was then that I realized that, God, the entire premise is these robots come to Earth, they find our machinery, and then they transform to look like our machinery. That's the premise. And once it was construction bots, oh, God, that's terrible. All right, and then the first Transformers movie when he converted the one little evil robot the Decepticon turns into what? A boombox? What did he turn into? A cassette tape? I can't remember. It was something stupid. But I'm like, yeah, oh, yeah, that's all they're doing is mimicking our technology, and that's how they're going to blend in, and it's stupid. The premise is horrible and was solely designed to sell toys. And we all know that, and yet we all somehow love the Transformers anyway. I don't think so. All right, it was cheap, blatant commercialism, and those of you who buy into it as nostalgia, you're just dumb. All right, and those of you who enjoyed the new movies, that's because you have no taste in movies. There. I have taken a firm position. I will stand by that. Number 86. This one's from Scree. Well, hey, Scree, I haven't seen you in a while. Scree says, when was your last awkward moment? And he puts awkward in quotation marks, so I don't know what that's supposed to mean. I am going to just take it at face value and just say, dude, I'm awkward all the time. I am very self-conscious about missteps and awkward situations, and they stick out in my head for a long time. And I'll just tell you, I have awkward moments. No, you know what? Those quotation marks are throwing me. I don't trust this question, Scree. I don't know what you're up to. I'm not having any part of it. That's it. Number 17. This one is from Serious Paul. Serious Paul says, if Judas Priest were to get a home cooking show, what would it be called? What a spectacular question, Paul. You don't know how many times a day people ask me this. And the answer, of course, is Iron Chef Man? I have no idea. Dude, seriously? Again, I can't be creative on the spur of the moment on this podcast. You need to give me time to research. That's why the meticulously potted portion comes out so well. It's because I have time to take notes. Not that I ever do, but I could. All right, I have time to think about them ahead of time. I'm going to have to turn this one over to the forums. We'll go look for answers down there. Number 64. Oh, wait, no, we already did 64. Okay. Number 20. This one is also from Sirius Paul. Do you think King Midas ever forgot and touched his own eyeballs or stuck his fingers in his ears? Dude, no, seriously, it doesn't affect him when he touches himself. I mean, Christ, his fingers touch each other when he makes a fist. His thighs rub together when he walks. He can't touch himself. I mean, if he could, well, this all would have been over really quick. I mean, then he'd just simply be done. Now, but that's the next question. Was it only his fingertips? I mean, because that's the only way that makes the story work, right? It would have to be his fingertips. So maybe it would. No, I don't think he ever did that, though. Because seriously, if one touch of my own fingertip could kill me, you can be pretty sure that would be something I would never forget. And in my sleep, I would have my hand locked in cages so that they couldn't come out and get me. All right? Because otherwise, yeah, I guess if it wasn't his fingertips, then pretty much his footprints behind him would turn to gold in the dirt or on the stone. His clothes would turn to gold. He wouldn't be able to wear them because they would drag him to the ground with their immense weight. It would be, yeah, God, that's got to be how it works. But either way, it doesn't make any difference. No, I do not think he ever accidentally turned any portion of himself to gold because, dude, seriously, that is not something you forget. Trust me on this. Number 29. This one's from Brett. No, God darn it, we rolled 29 already. All right, hold on. Number 58. That is better. Seriously, R2, if you cannot shape this up, I will be looking for another droid, I promise you. Number 58 is, again with the Sirius Paul. All right, Sirius Paul says, Serenity versus Deep Space Nine, who wins? All right, it depends. Is this in reality, or is this in a story we're telling? All right, because if it's in reality, Deep Space Nine would wipe out Serenity in a heartbeat, because it's Deep Space Nine, for goodness sake. It's an entire space station with the armament that goes along with that, versus this not even up to the level of the Millennium Falcon, fallen-apart Firefly-class smuggler ship with its ragtag crew. And no, they would get wiped out. Serenity would not last a second against Deep Space Nine. But that's not the point. If it's in an actual story, all right, if it's in a movie or a TV show, then clearly Serenity wins. Why? Well, because they're the little guy, all right? And in this particular conflict, Deep Space Nine would have to become the establishment. And we all know that Serenity will ultimately win out over the establishment. That's just the way the storyline works. All right, period. You can't stop Captain Mal. All right, you certainly can't stop River Tam, right? Okay. Settled. Number 69, dude. This one, oh, it's a long one, and it's from Anonymous. Oh, I haven't had an Anonymous in a while. This must be an old one. So, okay, and as I'm looking ahead, I realize that, yeah, if it's from Anonymous and it's that old, it's probably no longer even a relevant question. But let me read it to you anyway. There's a guy who hangs out with my group of friends all the time. And he's not weird or anything, but he's just really insistent about wanting to hang out and do stuff. And he can be kind of a dick, but I don't know if he's mean or just awkward or what. Anyway, I can only take him in small doses. And I want to be nice, but if I agree to go hang out with him, even for a little bit, then he's calling me and texting me nonstop for like a week. And then he gets mad if he thinks I'm not hanging out with him enough. And it's not just me. He does this to other people I know, too. And for me, to top it all off, our older brothers used to be best friends, so our families all know each other, or they expect us to be best buds or something. I don't want to be a dick, but it's getting to the point where I don't ever want to see him at all anymore because I know it's just going to lead to conflict. What do I do? All right, I got to start making a rule against these sorts of questions. I cannot be an advice column because I'm so bad at this. Especially with this one, I'm like, I understand, you know? I understand that there are annoying people who cling on and they cause problems and you can't handle it and you want to push them away. All right, but then I also know what it's like to be the dude on the other side. I know what it's like to be the dude who desperately wants to fit in and desperately needs a place and you're just really bad about it. You know, he gets an inch, just a little bit of encouragement, and suddenly, oh God, I have to make the most of this while it lasts. I hang on for dear life. Never let go. White knuckle this thing until you crush it, which is what's happening. And all it does is drive people away. I don't have any good advice other than you can try being honest with him. I mean, because he's going to be around. He's going to be around a lot, and you're going to run into him, and you're going to have conversations with him, and there's just no way to stop that. But yeah, like you say, if you give him anything, then suddenly you've got a week of having to put up with oh my God, are we going to do something? Are we going to do something? Hey, you want to hang out? Hey, you want to go? Well, why aren't you hanging out with me? Why won't you be the brother? I understand. And so maybe it's just a matter of being honest and saying, all right, dude, here's the deal. You're overbearing and annoying. You've got to stop doing that. I don't even know if that would work. I have no answer. You know what? I do have an answer. I am going to edit this question out of the podcast entirely, and then you guys will never know about it. How's that work for you? Hey, although, speaking of which, I have been asking you guys for your approval a lot during this episode. I think that's saying something about me psychologically. I think I'm a little needy right now. Am I insecure about the podcast? Am I looking for your approval? Is that what's going on? What do you think? Do you think that's what I'm doing? I'm a little worried. Number 29. This is all right. This is the third time, R2. We've already done 29. Give me another one. Ooh, number 4. That's better. Number 4 is from a Stan, and Stan says, which robots, droids, androids are you most attracted to? If it's a shorter list, name the ones you're not attracted to. Now, this question comes from Stan, so when he says attracted, I can only imagine that he means physically, sexually attracted to. And therefore, it's a very short list now I can't even remember her name. Why am I drawing a blank on this? Oh, Sean Young from Blade Runner. That's it, all right? Back when Sean Young was never, she was attractive in her day. She was attractive, but she was even more attractive when she had all that crazy going on, all right? When she was young and super crazy, and you could just see it in her eyes, there was something really hot about that. So Sean Young as a replicant in Blade Runner, I was attracted to that. I will tell you that one for sure. Other than that, I don't know. I got a thing for R2, obviously. I mean, I keep him here on the show, and I go for that short, boxy type. I mean, that's hot, right? Am I right? Okay. But no, I don't have a whole lot of, I don't have a whole lot of other androids or robots that I'm terribly attracted to. You know what? Although after this show, I know I'm going to go start a post about this because I'm going to go do some research, and I'm going to type in a Google search for hot robots or attractive female robots or whatever it is, and if I filter out the porn, I'm sure I'm going to come up with a list of like 20 female robots that have appeared in tons of things that I know of, and I'd go, oh God, that's right, I forgot about her. Oh yeah, okay. But for right now, I'm just going to leave it at replicants, and that's it. Oh, I guess Daryl Hannah was a replicant in that one too, wasn't she? All right, so Sean, I guess female replicants in general seem to be a pretty good bet on this one. All right, I'll go with that. Boom, 44. We're going to make this one the last one. 44 is from Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, you are a druid, a Dungeons & Dragons druid, I assume, and you have the power to change into a small animal, yep, Dungeons & Dragons druid, once per day for an hour at a time. If you could pick only one animal form, what would it be? It's got to be a small animal. All right. I'm going to go bird. All right. And it's just, well, all right. Here's my problem with any small animal that I pick. Because my first thought was mouse. And I knew I didn't want to be a mouse or a squirrel or any of that. But when I think small animal, that's the first thing that comes to my head. I don't want to be a mouse because I'm going to get killed. I'm going to get eaten by a cat or a dog or caught in a trap. Well, I guess I'd be smart enough to not get caught in the trap. But still, somebody's going to kill me if I'm a mouse. All right. So then I think, well, all small animals have this danger. So, bird. At least then I can fly, because flying would be so cool. How much would you love to have the ability to fly? And so then, but here's the problem. Birds have their own dangers. I mean, I'm not going to be worried about getting sucked into a jet engine. I'm not going that high. I'm not going to go near the airport. But, you know, what if I get eaten by something? So a bird of prey of some sort. And here's where we are fortunate with birds, is that all birds count as small animals for the most part. I mean, at least if they have the ability to fly, even if they look big, they don't weigh that much. I mean, when you're talking like a falcon or a hawk, you're talking the thing weighs under a pound. All right, these are not heavy animals. They got the hollow bones. Remember, they're all feathers and fluff, but really they're really light underneath. So, you know, make me a hawk. Make me a hawk or even like a black eagle. Something like that. All right, a bird of prey, so I don't have a whole lot to worry about from other predators. All right, put me near the top of the food chain for when I'm in animal form, so I don't have a whole lot of danger. But I still have the ability to fly and be really cool and awesome for that hour a day. All right, that's my answer. I'm going to go with hawk. That's my answer.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. This week's theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. Our bumper music comes from Weezer's In the Garage, William Shatner's cover of She Blinded Me with Science, and Me First and the Gimme Gimmies with Science Fiction Double Feature. All of these songs are awesome. They're all available on iTunes. Go check them out. Go buy them. Go enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love every single one of them. If you feel like doing something nice for the podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review. Or if you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, but no one does that. Better is to go over to our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums, sign up, send me a message, we'll hang out together, we'll have fun. No, so seriously, dudes, I went to the drive-in this weekend with my family, and we had a blast. All right, I happen to live within an hour's drive of one of the few remaining drive-ins in the country, the only drive-in theater in Nebraska, and this was their Labor Day special. We went Sunday night, $25 for a whole carload of people. All right, as long as everyone has seatbelts. They don't want you packing 14 people into your little four-door. But for $25, we all got in. We got a great double feature. We got to see Brave, which we had all already seen before, but we love Brave. It's a great movie. Had a great time. And then after Brave, here was the real surprise, Madagascar 3. My son, my oldest son, had seen it before and told me it was the best of the Madagascar series, which doesn't necessarily say much, but I'm like, all right, cool. But he wasn't kidding. Madagascar 3 was incredible. I had so much fun watching Madagascar 3. I would watch that again in a heartbeat. It was a great time. Well, here's the deal about the drive-in movie. If you haven't had a chance to go to a drive-in movie, you are missing out. I can't believe I still run into people who have lived here within an hour's drive of a drive-in movie theater. They've lived here for 20 years, and they've never gone. How do you pass up that opportunity? We go at least once every summer. All right, that's always our goal, is at least once. And it's just, it's an experience. It's awesome, all right? Because they don't do the little, you know, speaker hanging in your window thing anymore. No, you pull in. We pull in with a minivan. But most people there have a minivan or a truck, all right? And you pull it in so that your back end is facing the screen, all right? And then you pull out your folding chairs, and everybody sits out. And instead of the little speakers now, you just bring a boombox. You just bring a radio, and you tune into, you know, 89.9 or whatever their station is, and it broadcasts the movie's soundtrack directly over, not soundtrack, but the sound, directly over your radio, and there you are. We have a great time. And they have a fully functioning old-timey snack bar there, the concession counter. I mean, they, in addition to all your typical movie concessions, you know, pop and popcorn and candy, nachos, they have a full grill with hamburgers and hot dogs, and they do pizza, and they have a ton of stuff. It is a great, great selection. And sadly, we don't ever partake of their concession stand because with a drive-in movie theater, you can bring your own stuff from home. It's the one movie theater where you can bring your own snacks and nobody can know or say anything. Wonderful. Well, we packed up a giant paper bag full of popcorn. We brought our own candy, our own pops. So for $25, the whole family gets to watch two movies, and that's it. It was spectacular. All right, now, there's some drawbacks because watching a movie on a drive-in movie screen is not the same as seeing it in a theater. All right, sometimes there's a little lighting issue. There's, you know, it's not quite perfect, but it's fun. All right, and we always have a good time doing it. And here's the sad part. The really sad part is this one's probably going to close. This may be their last year because in this day and age, if you don't go to digital projectors, you don't get movies anymore. All right, and they've discovered that if they don't switch to digital by next year, they're not going to have enough movie selection to be able to remain open and remain viable. And their claim is that going to digital projector is going to cost them $200,000, $200,000, and they're seeking donations in order to try and keep this thing alive. And I hope they make it. My wife and I have talked about possibly donating some money to them because it's something that we've enjoyed every year since we've been married, and something that we look forward to taking our children to every year, and I'd hate to see it disappear. So, and it made me wonder. We were asking the question around work, why aren't there more drive-in movie theaters out there? Why don't more people do this? You would think the nostalgia factor would kick in for a lot of people, and it's just a cool, unique experience. It really is. But then we realized that, you open up a theater and put in all the investment that goes into a theater, and, at least here where we live, you can only operate about 6 months, 7 months out of the year before the snow shuts you down or the cold shuts you down. No one wants to go out and watch a movie when it's 30 degrees outside. Plus, you can only have, you know, you run your double feature, you only have one showing per night, all right? And it starts at sundown. Well, actually, it starts about a half hour after sundown and then runs until, I mean, during the height of summer, movie doesn't start till 9:45, and that means that after you watch a double feature, sometimes we're not done there until 2 in the morning, all right? So it's big, all right? It's an awkward time. And so, yeah, you wind up, you can only run half the year. You can only do one show a night. And, if it rains, well, you're screwed. So you're at the whims of the weather. And, of course, now you got to get a digital projector. So I understand why it's dying. I understand why more people aren't investing in it. It's the kind of thing that, if you've got an existing place, sure, run with it. Keep it going. You know, all the investment's already been made. But to start something new from scratch, oh man, you'd have to have other interest in it to keep it going. I mean, I thought maybe somebody who owns a theater already, and you open up a drive-in as kind of a second-run location for some of the movies you've already had at your theater, and now they're in second-run status, and so you take them out to the drive-in, and you should, but I don't know. It's just a pipe dream of mine. I just like to see the drive-in stay open. I just like to see the options be there, and it looks like it's not going to be. So that's kind of sad. Yeah, that's how I should end a podcast, on a really down note. There you go.